Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Two minutes past the hour. I was a little bit, well, there's, on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays when Dr. Bill is here, there's a little bit of a turnaround time between the end of his program and me getting this one started, so that's why it starts a little bit later on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays. But this is Titanic Tuesday. It is the 6th day of August, 2013. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com. Your home for what we like to call conversation radio, available at headonradionetwork.com with the listen live button or via the various and sundry streams, stream links that are available, for instance, at whiterosesociety.org, where you will also, in the subdomain for this program, find the podcast feed address, or you can get the podcast at iTunes. If you want to take the horn with you when you're out and about in the car, if you're, well, goodness me, it's between 3, it's, well, we're 3 to 6 p.m. on the Pacific Coast, so what a great time in the Pacific time zone to be listening in your car. I love the new gizmos that allow you to Bluetooth stream audio into your car stereo. It's really nice. Wish I had one. Someday, maybe. Someday. But the streaming apps for your smartphones and tablet devices and so forth, like, TuneIn Radio and Stitcher Internet Radio. A lot of platforms out there. Dar.fm, Streama.com. Yeah. So, it's all there for your listening pleasure. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. It is, as noted, Titanic Tuesday on the horn. And a reminder, Dr. Bill will be live from 3 to 5 tomorrow Eastern Time. That would be noon to 2 Pacific Time, and not 4 to 6 or 1 to 3 Pacific Time. Dr. Bill has meetings tomorrow evening. And then next week, we will be running some, we'll go back and review some previous Dr. Bill discussions, some of his discussions, as he will be traveling. So, all good? Good. Me, I'm going to be right here. Now, well, let's start off with the fact that we ended a mite short last night, but, well, we got a note. I conjured Scott in Sweden. I woke up this morning and found a note, well, not this morning, but this afternoon. And there it was in the inbox. Hey, Bob or Rebob. Some hornies are conjured, others get invitations. Did I just receive a summons? Yeah, somewhere between the two. There I was, minding my own business, getting plastered yet again all last week and today, along with my wife. I don't get a lot of notes that begin "there I was getting plastered." There's something charming, and I recall Daffy Duck Private Eye. I had just finished an old case. I needed a new case, and throwing the old case of beer bottles out the window. Anyway, there I was, minding my own business, getting plastered yet again. All that aquavit, all last week and today, along with my wife. When you stated that I would be running to the keyboard to respond to U.S. child abuse. That used to be my Pavlovian response, but few things about the U.S. seem to shock me anymore. Amend that. Few regressive, mean-spirited things shock me, but I do sit up suddenly perplexed when I hear of something very good happening. I've long since come to expect the worst, but that may largely be due to the company I keep. You, Malloy, Peter Werby, and all of you tend to feature the morality of it all. and thus it's a screened version of home sod news I get. Not that I believe it to be inaccurate. I don't. It's just that good news is seldom featured. And I should probably do a better job of that. I might even have one of those stories this evening via our buddy Mark Carlin over at BuzzFlash via Truthout. As for the summoning, I think you've covered the nastiness of corporal punishment of kids very well. But from the point of view here in Sweden, that's how he writes it, Sweden, it's exactly as you predicted. There is no debate. Sweden was the first country to ban it, but surprisingly late, 1979. But that's only because Swedish conservatives, the usual suspects, fought against it since 1922, when banning corporal punishment was first proposed. See how long sometimes it takes to get a good idea through? Let's see, 9 minus 2 is 7, 7 minus 2. Yeah, 57 years when banning corporal punishment was first proposed. Still, why it was ever seen as a useful thing, says Scott in Sweden, beats me. You read a list of counties that have also banned it, but I think many of these have done so secondary to ratifying the UN's Convention on the Rights of the Child. And naturally, if it comes from the UN, well, enough said for most Americans. Agenda 21! Now then, that the UN was the U.S. own idea. Now, since I've not written lately, but habitually make notes on scraps of paper while listening, let's see. Where are the Kincaid scraps? No scraps over here. Maybe under here. Those wadded and torn ones are the Malloy notes. Yeah, found some! Good boy, Barney. Oh, you're dead. Well, we had you stuffed. One, this scrap says, watch the blood pressure. That must be a Wednesday note. Two, about millennium, millennia. You asked all of us, are there any linguistic expressions that go through you like an electric current? Better sit down, Bob. This is the dreaded goddess of irony seeking you out, I'm afraid. Well, it's the increasingly ubiquitous good instead of well in the U.S., which to me makes fingernails on a chalkboard the chirping of a blackbird. On the other hand, at times, what my Swedish does to some Swedes is considered neither creative nor forgivable. No one is immune. Next note. All's well. It's all good. I had to do that to you, Scott. Three, my daughter heard you mention the flying spaghetti monster last week, and wants to know if their version of Satan would be called the antipasto. I know, I should never have taught her English. The Italian is on her high school's conscience. Wait, stop. What? A child goes to high school in Sweden and learns Italian in high school in Sweden, Italian. What's the Swedish for screwed? Because the United States, we are. They're teaching their children Italian in high school. Well, that obviously means they'll never be able to compete with the Indians and the Chinese for those 29-cent-an-hour jobs that the global economy is based on, All right. Four, about almost winning the Powerball. You can relax, Bob. You are no more snickdit than is any other person. This is because the numbers drawn do not... See, this is where I should have taken the statistics class instead of the existentialism and the modern pastry chef back there when I was choosing electives. This is because the numbers drawn do not mean what you think they mean. If you replace each number with another image, such as a kitten for number one, a nail clipper for number two, an induction coil for number three, and so on, all different non-related images, you get a truer feel of what's going on statistically, presuming each ball is actually selected randomly. That number 46 that was almost a 47 or whatever your set of near misses was is merely an artifact that they choose to represent the balls with sequential integers instead of a shark's tooth, a thumbtack, a wristwatch, spring, etc. Had they done so, you'd not be left with a feeling of almost my number, because using sequential numbers plays on your mind's sense that two adjacent numbers mean something, which it would if we were talking about something scalable like temperature or price or test scores. But here, we are not, It's a ruse to make you think you'll be luckier next time. The only way you can talk about almost winning is if they use a mechanical selecting device, if you can see which balls were almost in the right spot to have been selected instead of the ones that were. Their facial values have nothing to do with it. It's kind of like how it's kind of like how in cards the value of a king, queen, jack, and ten are all the same, right? Am I getting there?
I'm trying so hard.
To find your real chances of winning, some basic statistics, and all you lottery players out there, pay attention. To find your real chances of winning, some basic statistical assumptions must hold. If no number can be repeated in any single draw, and if no six-digit sequence is ever repeated, and if you buy 52 tickets a year, let's see, with Powerball it would be 104, but never mind. The number of years needed to be sure of a winning six-digit sequence is 50 times 49 times 48 times 47 times 46 times 45 divided by 52, or would that be 104, and is approximately 219 million years. It's going to be a long time. Had your ancestors, and this is not just pre-Cretaceous and pre-Jurassic Kincaids, but early Triassic Kincaids we're talking about, say a proto-Kincaid Lystrosaurus or Proterosuchus, but more likely a proto-Kincaid Cynognathus, a mammal-like cynodont, faithfully bought one lottery ticket a week and only one spawn, chick, cub, pup, child Kincaid per generation to keep the wealth in one set of claws, paws, hands, your Herbert Hoover Day of Prosperity would be just around the corner any centimillennium or meganium now. Really does bring everything into perspective, doesn't it? Maybe that's why the scratch-off games do have nail files and daisies and watch springs and tiny bells. It's every bit as relevant, isn't it? Jesus, the lights are on. And five, apropos of newspapers, Little Stockholm, population 2 million, has 5 daily newspapers. P.S., thanks for saying happy birthday. A nice surprise. Here's my birthday challenge to the horn, a variation of the Beat the Swede theme. First, I'm pay pirating $50 today to meet last night's unmet $100 challenge. And if all use hornies, meet the full August goal and fill in the July hole as a bonus to Bob's second full-time job of trying to save his region's inhabitants from an early grave, decrepitude, or invalidity, I'll sponsor September the 1st solo to get the next month off to a good start. No, it is not blackmail. It is a way of making every contribution between today and the end of the month count a little extra. Wow. Cool. So, yes, we finished up meeting Darlene's challenge from last night, thanks to Scott, which means that we are roughly in, well, it's $150 we try to raise every evening, and so, yeah, $300. About $300. And we'll be out of July's hole and even with where we're supposed to be now. So that's what it, right, we're trying, that's what, yeah, $330, 10 people, and we're done with tonight. Finally, Brigitte and I will be getting just a little plastered tomorrow, too, but that ought to be the last time, as I think the walls and ceiling are just about ready for painting. Ho-ho! He shoots, he scores. So tomorrow we'll be getting painted instead while listening to your show. We chose not to go with sheetrock and to stick to the same materials as when the house was built, but hooey, applying wet plaster is an art I've not mastered. No, but by God, the couplet is. It ends up all over the place from noggin to toe to boot, but persistence, lots of power sanding the boo-boos away. I thought that was bonobos for a minute. Time for another trip to my old buddy the optician. Power sanding the boo-boos away does pay off. It's almost as smooth as we're ever going to get it. Luckily, very nearby Lake Malaren, I'm trying, Scott, is relatively warm this summer, and plaster isn't a declared pollutant, so the late afternoon plunge is the penultimate act of the workday. The workday officially ends on the back porch, with the pouring of the homemade stout. Skull, your buddy Scott. Not just my buddy Scott, your buddy Scott. Our buddy Scott. That's how I signed it. Our buddy Scott. Wow. What a great way to begin a program. And now we have a new web. Or new word. Now we have a new word. Randy, writing in from PA, lottery type math is within a mathematical field called combinatorics. And it apparently is very profitable for certain for-profit lottery companies. Hey, thanks, Sal, for getting us started this evening. 29 to go. Really appreciate it. Sal's there night in and night out. Now, All right, so a couple of different places to go. I have a feeling I know what's going to be happening with me after the program ends this evening. Granted, far greater writers than I will ever be have found it quite salubrious to crack open something cold and fermented before letting the outrage machine go and hammering away on the keyboard like you're the last journalist out of Saigon in 1975. And lo and behold, today, an op-ed appeared in the pages of the Beckley newspaper. And I had my attention called to it by the fine folks over at ACCCE, the American Clean Coal Cancer Enterprise or something. You may remember we talked about them last week because you apparently have to refer to their president who has a quotation, who has quotation marks in the middle of his name. That guy. Yeah, Joe Manchin. Let me just give you the beginning, because you're going to love it. When it comes to coal, Joe Manchin wrote this, which means one of Joe Manchin's aides wrote this, or quite possibly the American Coalition for Coal Cancer Enterprises wrote it. Who knows? But it wasn't Joe. Joe's a busy man. When it comes to coal, President Obama and the EPA are clearly hell-bent on putting the coal industry out of business forever. That's how it starts. I'm not going to go into the rest of it because I'll ruin the attempt to sit down. Because this has got to be countered in print. But can I just point something out? Do you reckon Joe Manchin ever felt the urge to allege that President Reagan was hell-bent? Because what does that mean? Words mean something, right? What does it mean to be hell-bent? I suspect that even though we have a largely irreligious audience, and some who are religious, and some who are outright hostile to religion. I suspect that because this is one of the most intelligent radio audiences in all the wide, wide world, we've all got a pretty good idea on what hell-bent means. To be hell-bent, I suspect, means to be oriented toward going to hell. To be willing to go to hell in furtherance of a particular goal. In this case, the junior senator from West Virginia alleges that President Obama is willing to, that he and the EPA are, and he uses the adverb clearly, I think when you see the word clearly in front of a phrase like hell-bent, that's an attempt to bolster the fact that there's no real evidence to support the assertion. But Joe Manchin says that President Obama and the EPA are clearly hell-bent on putting the coal industry out of business forever. That means, according to the junior senator from West Virginia, and aren't you glad he isn't yours, unless you're listening from inside West Virginia, that means that Joe Manchin has just alleged that Barack Obama, the President of the United States, you know, that one, is willing to trade his immortal soul, and immortal souls are something that Joe allegedly believes in, all the way from the time that they're itsy-bitsy fetuses to whenever they're being, you know, poisoned to death by the coal industry. The junior senator from West Virginia has just alleged that the President of the United States is willing to swap his immortal soul in order to put the coal industry out of business forever. Kudos to Joe, however, for figuring, for getting smartened up somewhere along the way. I don't know, maybe he's listening. Hi, Joe! Because, you know, for the longest time, he's like, coal provides half of America's electrical energy. And then he started saying, well, coal provides almost half of America's electricity. And then he said, coal provides 40+% of America's electricity energy. And lo and behold, here on the 6th day of August, 2013, Senator Joe now says coal currently generates almost 40% of the electricity in America. Almost! Missed it by that much. And that's about as good as this whole thing gets. It goes... I know you find it difficult to comprehend, but it goes steadily downhill from there. Why, thank you, Lottie. Nice of you to take cards in the game. Lottie in the chat room saying, I'll see your immortal soul and raise you 2 lifetime karmas. And Stockton Larry noting, doesn't Senator Munchum realize that Obama is godless and therefore has no soul? That's the way it is with those Kenyans, you know. But that's the quality of statesmanship as it obtains here in almost level West by God, Virginia. But a journalism question, since we talked a little journalism last night, and since it is Titanic Tuesday, a journalism question. Is hell-bent good journalism language? Now, I'm not being prudish, and I am certainly no Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm, nor am I some sort of shrinking violet who, oh my profanity, my ears are burning, get me the smelling salts and the fainting couch. No. But if this, is it good language? Is it good usage? Is it statesmanlike to allege that the President of the United States has swapped his soul for the ability to put the coal industry out of business forever? Is it your opinion matters? This is Conversation Radio, and consequently, if you want to share your feelings on that, well, goodness me, there's a wide variety of means of doing it, at Bob Kincaid on the Twitter, or Bob Kincaid on Facebook, or BobKincaid@gmail.com on the emails, if you want to send me an internet via the series of tubes. It's not a big truck. It never gets old. Just love that. I hope they put that on Senator Stevens' tombstone. It's not a big truck. And, of course, there's always the traditional phone lines and the Skype line. On Skype, it's Bob Kincaid Horn. And on the phones, it's 304-658-3333. Is that good language? And don't feel hypocritical just because we throw around some common terms that are even coarser than that here. This is not a newspaper, and we are not running around out there trying to convince people with greater or lesser degrees of success, as is Joe Manchin, that we are statesmen. So, your thoughts are more than welcome. So there's that. And there's a lot of that. This being Thorn in the... No, this is Titanic Tuesday. Named for the Titanic intellect of the right wing. Titanic plates being... the movement of which being the reason that there are fossilized seashells in the rock strata of West Virginia. I guess we should just be lucky that the person who coined that didn't say that Satan put the seashells in the rock strata to confuse the unbelievers. Man, that was a busy day he had. Satan hiding all them dinosaur bones to confuse all us unbeliever types. I said that there might actually be some good news in the program today, and maybe I should make a better effort at trying to find a little bit. And let's... Well, yeah, there is somewhere to be proud of that some particular someones in the Horn family commune will be proud to hear. I think of I think of Richmond, I think of Richard, and I think particularly of our buddy Tom. Via Mark Carlin, via Buzzflash at Truthout, headline: Richmond, California unshackles ex-prisoners to find jobs by prohibiting employer blacklisting. She sells seashells by the seashore. Rubber baby buggy bumpers. The sixth sheep's sick. Blacklisting. And writing at Buzzflash, truthout.org/Buzzflash. Mark Carlin, who has been on this program in the past, reports on the fact that Richmond, California, a little bit north of San Francisco, there on the beautiful, beautiful waters of the bay, and which the images of which will live forever in my memory, Richmond, California has threatened to use the city's powers of eminent domain to seize properties threatened with foreclosure from banks and secondary lenders. That would allow Richmond, in turn, to resell the houses to the owners of the houses at current market value, which the banksters ought to be doing, but find it not nearly as profitable to do as it is to just simply steal stuff from people like their houses. Mark Carlin also recounts the fact that the city of Richmond, California, is suing Chevron for a 2012 refinery fire that sickened about 15,000 people. I don't know. Has Chevron asked for everybody in Richmond's email address yet? Don't worry, they will. And then this. It is admittedly difficult for people to find work when they have gotten out of America's punishment fetish complex, otherwise known as prison. And they are enacting a city ordinance that would prohibit employers inside Richmond, California, from asking if a person who has served time has a criminal background. It's a checkoff box. Have you ever been convicted of a crime? Yes, no. Well, that box is going to have to go away inside Richmond, California. the ordinance has been approved. It forbids employers from requiring applicants to reveal their criminal histories at any point during the application or hiring process. It was a 6-1 vote. It wasn't even close. It takes effect next month, September. A Huffington Post story noted that the similar ordinances have been passed in other cities around the U.S., but none have done what the Richmond ordinance does. It makes it clear that applicants need not require or need not disclose criminal histories at any point of the application and hiring process, including during the final rounds of interviews or even after they're hired. It's pretty damned impressive, unless I'm just reading this wrong. Hey, thanks. Thanks to the Angry Indian on Twitter for putting a little word out there that he's listening to the horn right now. Thanks, Angry. It is possible to get stuff right. All that is required is for people of goodwill to do the right thing once you've gotten the people of goodwill into positions of authority. I know many of us rebel at the very idea of the word authority, but, you know, some sort of governmental structure. Maybe authority's not the right power. Oh, ick. And this, of course, this kind of proactive governance is the direct polar opposite of something, of, if you were listening to Dr. Bill, and if you weren't, why weren't you? You know, the people who are listening to Dr. Bill are becoming progressively more informed than people who aren't listening to Dr. Bill. It's just that simple. But Dr. Bill was talking about the rise of public service commissions during his program this afternoon. Remember, he starts at 3 p.m. Eastern tomorrow. And Dr. Bill pointed out, and Waggy in the Horn chat room distilled it perfectly, that whereas most people think that that things like public service commissions and regulation of utilities was a progressive step forward, well, if you were listening to Dr. Bill, you know that no, as Waggy succinctly distilled it, public service commissions were born in captivity, and they have been the captive pets of plutocratic utility owners and public service providers ever since. Pretty impressive dodge. Well, what Richmond, California is doing is dramatically different. Almost makes a fellow wonder. Nah, couldn't happen. God, wouldn't it be cool, though? The Horn broadcasting live from its new home base in Richmond, California? Nah, I'm sure they've got plenty of progressive broadcasters out there that don't need some hillbilly. Yeah. But I promised you some good news, and there it is. Giving people a fighting chance to actually fix their lives after they've run afoul of the punishment fetish complex of the state of California or the United States. All this comes on the heels of the implementation, the pending implementation of AB 109, Assembly Bill 109, that reduces prison overcrowding in California by releasing thousands of low-level inmates by the end of this year, 2013. Councilwoman Jovanka Beckles said, "We're going to have a lot of folks coming back from incarceration and looking for work here soon." I'm sure the gun goobers are out there bracing for the zombie ex-con apocalypse. I don't know. Do we have any gun stories out there? Hey, before I get too far into the process, I want to share a note with you because it is an anniversary. Or, as FDR termed something a couple of years before this incident, a day that will live in infamy. And it is. Tim from L.A. writes, I don't know if I should cry because of what happened to my aunt on August the 6th, 1945, only to die 6 months after 9/11, or cry because no one cares what happened 68 years ago. Witnesses saw a flash brighter than the sun pierce the morning sky, then a blast of hot air threw the victims across the room or outside like the flowery seed of a dandelion as a child blows upon the bulb. The blast was deafening. The earth shook like an earthquake. Metal and glass performed an eerie orchestral sound of death as Little Boy blew the life out of more than 245,000 human beings, including American POWs like Army Sergeant Ralph J. Neal, Army Sergeant Buford J. Ellison, and Ensign John J. Hanschel. As well as my aunt, though, 57 years later. The horror she spoke of to my parents was amazingly astonishing and sickening. How Colonel Paul Tibbett, on his deathbed, had no qualms whatsoever dropping the bomb on my aunt's hometown of Hiroshima. The vile and disgust, the vileness and disgusting nature of an automaton having no consideration not only of the Japanese but of Americans living in Hiroshima or his buddies who were POWs. It was so maddening that Toho Company Limited, the same creator of old Japanese classics like Ikiru and Shichini no Samurai, Seven Samurai. How'd I do, Tim? Pronunciation wise. Made the dragon lizard monster Gojira, Godzilla, in the U.S. protesting the nuclear weapons. Yet have we learned, Tim asks, and because of our stupidity, are we being punished today by the Manhattan Project waste product, which may have been leaking since the 1960s, and thus for more than 40 years? I was born in 1963. We're getting closer to 50. Damn. Is this their vengeance? Is this the 245,000-plus dead who prayed for vengeance for the 12 POWs who were murdered by Tibbetts? For our lack of care and to end the practice of destroying our planet? And the death of possibly 14,000 stillbirths in the Pacific Northwest? Living in West Virginia as you do, Bob, mountaintop removal causes the same effect my aunt went through. Will cancer and other health ills be the vengeance by Mother Nature because of the destruction of the Appalachian Mountains? The collective lack of care by its people? The death of a town, state, because the democratically elected officials bow to big coal? See Joe Manchin, previous. Tim answers his own question. Yes. And many people don't give a shit about it because Paris effing Hilton is more important than sick hillbillies in coal. No. Paris effing Hilton is so effing last decade, Tim. Now it's Kim effing Kardashian is more important than sick hillbillies in coal country. Possibly some 14,000 dead infants in the Pacific Northwest, or that 12 U.S. POWs, heroes, as they are called today, are dead. Bob, no one cares, but I'm goddamn glad your voice is heard. And more than that, Tim, I can proudly say that I'm equally glad that I can help to share yours. Peace, Bob. Peace to you, Tim. Peace to you. I never should have said anything. Dan writes, "Hey, Bob, we got some progressive stations in the Bay Area, but we've lost several. Come on out." Oh, God, I'd go in a minute. We can't keep the lights on here. Oh, my God. Illegal employment question. This in from Randy in PA. When I was applying for employment, I was asked if I'd ever been arrested, not whether or not I'd ever been convicted of a crime. See, I don't think you can even ask that. If that's a loophole, at least it sounds like Richmond's city council is willing to close it. Have you ever been arrested? Yeah, most of the people I know would have to. Yeah, well, there was that time outside the coal prep plant, or you know, there was that time outside the EPA, or there was that time in the Senate office, or right. Like I said, Titanic Tuesday, and speaking of Titanic Tuesday. We got some prime examples. Texas, North Carolina. And I know, because I was listening last night. I know many of you who listen to Malloy have already heard him discuss this, but I just got to float the audio out there. This is Ted Yoho, Republican of Florida, talking to the freaks.
I had a little Obama banner, and I told him about the sun tanning tax, and he goes, I didn't know what was in there. I said, yes, 10% tax. I said, he goes, well, he goes, that's probably not meant, that's the big of a deal. I said, it's a racist tax.
He started laughing. Did you hear how long that applause went on? Now, this is Ted Yoho, Yoho. Right. I hope. No, I'm not going to do that. Alleging that a so-called tanning bed tax that is within the four corners of the patient protection, emphasis on protection, and, well, one of those things we like to protect people from is skin cancer! Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Is racist. It's racist tax. The audio here is kind of terrible. And so, my apologies, but, you know, I didn't record it. Otherwise, it wouldn't be like this. They were still laughing. Damn, I didn't realize there was more clapping and laughing to be had. That gang of knuckle-walking, mouth-breathing freaks. Hear that? Hey, he said they was being racist against us. Oh, well, dang, Eileen. Yeah, how about I reckon we're going to have to get us a tanning bed. What's that black speck up on my... must be catching. Yeah. An actual member of the House of Representatives has alleged that a tax on tanning beds is racist against pale-skinned people, when in fact one would argue that his real argument is with evolutionary processes or a creationist God, because remember, it was a gift from a born white. By the grace of God, right? American by birth, Southern by the grace of God. His issues are not with President Obama. His issues are with the absence of a certain substance called melanin in his skin, but never mind. Let us go back to the hee-haw by the people who are... See, that's the point I wanted to make. Malloy covered this brilliantly last night, of course, as Malloy does any given time. But the underlying reality of this is not what Ted Yoho says, but how his audience responds.
You know what? It is. And I had a new doctor in our office the other day.
Boner started laughing. The underlying reality is in all the guffaws and hee-haws. Because when you laugh at a piss poor attempt at humor like that, what you're saying is that you don't believe. And I know what I'm doing when I use the word believe. You don't believe racism is real. Or if you do believe it is real, you believe it is appropriate. Now, hold on.
And he goes, you know what? It is. And I had an Indian doctor in our office the other day.
I had an Indian doctor in the office the other day. What for, Yoo-hoo? Never mind.
Very dark skin and two non-dark skinned people. And I asked, I said this to him, and they started laughing. And I said, have you ever been to a painting booth? He goes, no, no need.
The dark-skinned man said he didn't need the tanning bed. Oh, tell me, Mr. Bones. This guy goes home and listens to Amos and Andy. He just does. Damn, they're funny. Ain't nothing funnier now. I like him old-time comedies. Well, them tea baggers is just a yucking it up, ain't they?
It's a racist tax, and I thought I might even go get to a suntanning booth twice so that I can come out and say I've been disenfranchised because I got taxed for the color of my skin.
See, I got taxed for the color of my skin. It boggles the mind. It has nothing to do with public policy and trying to cut down on a very real problem, and that is the ever-growing incidence of skin cancer. Listen, just for a minute. I don't. Robert, you out there? Angry Architect? Any of you guys? Any of y'all? I remember having a conversation with John Fox about how daggone sunny and hot it can get there where y'all are. Are there idiots in Australia using tanning beds? I'm serious. This is a serious question, because it's my understanding that skin cancer and campaigns to prevent skin cancer have actually been put forward in Australia. Y'all got tanning beds? Are people still laughing about how dark the people from India are? And of all them black-faced crew, the finest man I knew was our regimental bestie, Gunga Dean. It was Dean, you limping lump of brick dust, where you been? You put some jewelry in it or I'll marrow you this minute, you miserable Gunga Dean. It's racist to not want people to die of skin cancer. The damned fools. Where's that line come from? What movie is that? The fools. Oh, yeah, Dr. Strangelove. The fools. The damned fools. Right? Someday I'm going to be a voiceover guy. No. But in that moment, I think we get to get a little slice of life for everything we could need to know about why racism has seen such a vile and virulent resurgence in this country. I can't get to a place in my head where I can sit down and feel like there's enough commonality to have a conversation to ask one of these teabaggers why it is they laugh when a man brings up the idea of racism. Because it is. It's the same thing as laughing at a comic in blackface. With, in this case, the doctor of Indian or Hindu descent of very dark skin standing in for Mr. Bones. It's funny how dark-skinned they are. This was not a joke at Speaker Boner's expense by any stretch of the imagination. No, hell no. But if I can't get to a place where I could understand a dialogue with those folks, I'm screwed for a group of folks in the Old Dominion, Old Virginia. I'm done. Via David Edwards at Raw Story, a group of Virginia residents say that they are purchasing a plot of land and intend to use it to fly a 15-foot Confederate battle flag in view of motorists driving on Interstate 95 near Richmond. Now, unless things have gotten considerably worse than I thought they were, and unless folks of slave descent have been banned from using I-95 near Richmond, what the hell is this any different than painting an effing swastika on a synagogue? Hint, none. They are calling themselves the Virginia Flaggers. The Virginia Flaggers are thrilled to announce that we have finalized a lease to acquire property adjacent to Interstate 95 just south of Richmond, and will be erecting a 50-foot pole. They can't help it. They can't help it. They don't realize. They are walking little lab rats for the goddess of irony. We will be erecting a 50-foot pole. Fact, well, I'm going to go see what my hub is up to. We'll be erecting a 50-foot pole. I wish it was 50 feet. We will be erecting a 50-foot pole. He keeps telling me it is. Erecting a 50-foot pole on which a 10-by-15 Confederate battle flag will fly 24/7, 365 days of the year. The flag will serve to welcome visitors and commuters to Richmond and remind them of our honorable Confederate history and heritage of effing treason. I added the effing treason part. You got that? That's what the flag's going to serve to do. They're not going to fly the flag of the United States of America. No, they're going to fly a symbol of treason. God, I am convinced more and more that one of those goddamned flags should have been braided into a noose and Robert E. Lee should have been hung by it. And Longstreet. And Pickett. And had he survived Stonewall Jackson, should have hanged a lot of them. John Bell Hood. Treason is a heartbeat. Deep. Within the body of the South. Susan Hathaway said the Virginia Flaggers got an excellent deal on a pole, and they're going to complete the project at a cost of just under $3,000. And see, this is where it gets difficult to carry on a conversation with these dumbasses. It was a year or so ago when Ms. Hathaway, Ms. what's her first name? Susan Hathaway. When Ms. Susan Hathaway explained to the Richmond Times-Dispatch that it was the Ku Klux Klan what had tarnished the reputation of the Confederacy. Never mind that the Confederacy, and, you know, in particular, one of its cavalry officers, invented the Ku Klux Klan, but we're not talking about history here. We're talking about stupidity. Has she actually got something to say here?
Was a Confederate soldier. Right up before, they found those soldiers, like, in the streets.
Crappy audio. It's this idiot white woman waving a Confederate battle flag. It is a symbol of my ancestors and what they fought for and what they gave their lives for in a lot of cases. We feel like it's dishonoring them to put some kind of shame on the flag and make it something that has to be hidden. No, sugar, it has to be destroyed. It ought to be burnt. Any enterprising Americans, I'm not even going to say progressives or liberals, any enterprising Americans care to hold a Confederate flag burning every day out there? But really, it's encapsulated ignorance. It's a symbol of my ancestors and what they fought for. So in other words, Susan, if indeed that is your name, what you're saying is that it's a symbol of the fact that your ancestors were treasonous, that they were traitors to their country, that they gladly not gave their lives, but tried to take the lives of people who remained loyal to this country, of which, for reasons unknown to me, you remain a citizen. Get out! Be gone! Idiots. God bless America. Too much to bear. So there goes our evening's filibuster. Lines are open, 304-658-3333. Or on the Skype line, Bob Kincaid Horn. Gmail, bobkincaid@gmail.com, Twitter, @BobKincaid, Facebook, Bob Kincaid. It's how we create the conversation. We are moving assiduously, we hope, toward meeting tonight's fundraising goal. We have one person stepping in, Sal, to make it, we need 29 folks at 10 bucks apiece, so that we can come even and have a nice clean slate and get out of the hole to carry through the rest of the month. Ah, there you are, Robert. A note in from Robert in Australia. Tanning beds, not in Oz. Bob, at the moment, we still have tanning beds here in Oz. New South Wales, Victoria, and South Australia have banned them from the beginning of 2015. Goodness knows why you'd want to use one. We have some of the highest rates of skin cancer in the world despite decades of the slip, slop, slap campaign. Slip on long-sleeved clothing, slop on sunscreen, and slap on a hat. Question from Robert, using his big human brain. How is using a tanning bed a tax? You choose to use it, it's not forced on you. Well, see, that's the whole thing, though. There's actually some sort of little pissant tax on the use of tanning beds, just like there's a tax on the use of cigarettes or snuff. In this state, there's a tax on the use of carbonated beverages, and beer, and liquor, and gasoline. But Robert's essential point is spot on correct. You don't use the tanning bed, you don't pay the tax. People with big human brains would then say, well, if I don't want to pay the tax, I won't use the tanning bed. But that, can you imagine, well, I don't know. What would John Boehner look like if he didn't have that whole Oompa Loompa thing going for him? I don't know. So anyway, jump into the conversation if you wish. And if you can help out and help us get out of the hole all the more the merrier. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. A little something from Jason Ringenberg.
This isn't Alabama. Oh, how will I know? I'm in central Germany, where I love to go. Then how come I am seeing right in front of me? My Lord, there flies a rebel flag in central Germany. My Lord, there flies a rebel flag in central Germany. Mercy. I was riding peaceful on this train, enjoying the scenery and mellowing my brain. Then stuck atop a pretty barn there for all to see. The omnipresent rebel flag in central Germany. A massive Confederate flag in central Germany. Oh boy, that's a rock.
Like I said, Jason Ringenberg, formerly of Jason and the Scorchers, from an album several, good gracious, 9 years ago, called Empire Builders, Rebel Flag in Germany. Awesome, awesome. By the way, I neglected to thank Sylvia. Sylvia contributed last night to help get us out of the hole. And thank you very kindly, Sylvia. It was much appreciated. She said, I find your show very interesting, but usually low volume makes listening difficult. You have interesting regular guests and thoughtful callers. I wish we could do something about the low volume, but if I push the limits very much, things degrade really fast. Wow, thank you. Thank you very much, Michael. We are now only... 26 folks at $10 apiece, and we are out of the hole and playing on level ground. 5 minutes past the hour, an hour and 5 minutes into this evening's program, this Titanic Tuesday, and we will go straightway to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. It's Juanita.
Well, hey, Juanita. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing okay. How about you?
I'm doing good.
Well, this is Titanic Tuesday, and I don't quite understand. Okay, now Titanic Tuesday is based on the right wing and the...
Well, the Titanic, the Titanic intellect of the right wing.
Okay.
And it comes from the fact that there was this right wing yammerhead down in Beckley. You know where Beckley is.
Yes, I know. My aunt, I know who you're talking about.
Oh, do you really?
O'Brien.
Yes.
Radio.
Yes. Different O'Brien. Different O'Brien altogether.
I know.
Just like last night's O'Brien in New Hampshire was a different O'Brien. We have to do that to protect the honor and integrity of Dr. Bill O'Brien here.
I know.
But yeah, he declared one day to one of his mouth-breathing faithful, who wanted to know from him, and this is a guy who once announced that the New River, which is the lifeblood of this little area where I live, you know the New River, that the New River flows south. He's a real genius. So one of his Jim once reported, having been listening to this titan of intellect, this man of Titanic wit, that he told the knuckle walking mouth breather that there are fossilized seashells in the sandstone rock strata and in the coal seams of West Virginia because of the movement of the Titanic plates. Which of course immediately sent me to thinking of the Titanic plates and the Titanic soup tureen and the Titanic gravy boat just all sliding down the table on that evening in April of 1912.
Well, I know one time I was down there and he was discussing the United Nations, and it was obvious that he didn't have a clue what the United Nations was even about.
Yeah, but I've often said that we need I needed to be more respectful of the guy, because I'm not kidding, Lottie. It is not easy to do this day in and day out and day in and day out, and pull up, you know, trying to come up with stuff to talk about and keep the conversation flowing and make the information interesting. That's difficult enough. To do it like he did it with absolutely no talent whatsoever, it's huge.
Yes. Well, I want to talk about the Titanic brain of one of us on the left, and I'm going to talk about Tom Hartman. There was an article posted on the Democratic Underground with an interview. I guess he went on reliable sources of CNN, along with Michael Harrison of Talkers Magazine,
mm-hmm.
and Michael Medved.
Oh, dear.
And there, Tom went on to help assure audiences that Limbaugh and Hannity would not be going anywhere. As a matter of fact, he described Rush Limbaugh. Now, this is Tom Hartman, is a brilliant and talented man. So,
well, if we define brilliance and talent as the ability to make great horse gagging loads of money, I guess he is the Einstein of his craft.
Yeah. Well, then he goes on to say that the boycott of Limbaugh was initiated by Media Matters, and that it had hurt progressive radio.
It did.
I know that's probably true. However, Bob, I remember in 2006 when Air America was still on the air, and the Democrats had taken back the House, and the narrative out of Air America, they were so excited because they thought that surely Clear Channel was going to expand progressive stations all over.
Why would they think that?
I don't know. But
well, let me back up and just clarify a little bit. And of course, this didn't touch me, except, well, it didn't touch the horn. I am not the horn. The horn is all of us. This didn't touch us because we make this happen on our own. And everybody sacrifices, from the people behind the microphone to the people who contribute to make all of this happen. It is one great big enterprise of sacrifice.
Yes.
And so, you know, the commercial aspects didn't touch us. But, yes, what happened, and this is the thinking, of the wee timorous beasties of the advertising world. The thought was, well, Rush Limbaugh said all that nasty crap about Sandra Fluck, and people are angry about it, and we got to get out of Rush Limbaugh. But you know what? Those progressives, they say mean things too. Never mind the fact that what Rush Limbaugh said about Sandra Fluck was nothing short of a libel, whereas merely speaking facts about the behavior of the right wing is not libelous, slanderous, or untrue.
Right.
But what they decided to do is, well, all right, we're not going to advertise Preparation H on Rush Limbaugh anymore, and so we're not going to advertise it on any progressive radio anymore either. As if the advertising world was some sort of kindergarten schoolmarm who was separating two bad children, when in fact one of the children, was not being bad at all.
Well, yeah, and you know, unfortunately, I don't believe. I think the right wing has convinced advertisers that left progressive radio is just as lethal, when it is not. I mean, you know, I see that posted all on various websites all the time. The extreme left wing and the extreme right wing in media. Now, where is the extreme left wing in media? I mean, what are they talking about? They talk about MSNBC as being extreme left wing media.
Well, all you have to do is search for a little while, Juanita, and you'll find who they're talking about.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to expand any further on that, because it is a line of it's a line of libelous crap leveled against one of my dearest friends.
Yes. Well, anyway, what I was saying about Clear Channel, when they took off the stations, they removed the one here in Ohio, several others in 2006, and then we all got petitions together and, you know, demanded that they reinstate the station. They eventually did, but when Obama won in 2008, they took the station off again. And then in 2012, they started pulling. Well, our station has been off since 2008, but I noticed that when 2012 occurred, they started pulling off some of the other stations, like, where was that one? It wasn't Seattle, Washington. It was.
Oh no! They pulled. They let's see. San Francisco lost. I think lost its progressive radio. And what was it in Portland and Seattle? Both they got flipped to, something like ESPN Sports Radio.
Yeah. And here
because see, you can but understand, Juanita, you can sell that stuff. First of all, no one is ever going to, and this is one of those reasons I'll never be on commercial radio, because I say things like this, no one is ever going to accuse a radio sales geek of being smart, okay? In a local market, the way you work the radio sales racket is you get yourself a little portfolio of car lots and, car dealerships, and furniture stores, and, you know, a few other, and you can make a comfortable living out of that, because radio sales is a racket. If you bring in a $1,000 contract, you get $150 of it, okay?
Yeah.
And the commission sales game is basically a pyramid scheme inside the radio station. It's where the general manager gets a cut, the sales manager gets a cut, the salesperson gets a cut, and somewhere down along the way they find a couple of pennies to rub together and pay the last pimply-faced teenager who's sitting there running the automation.
Exactly.
It is, you cannot, you, it, whoever thought that they could make a killing in creating giant nationwide radio behemoths was an idiot. Okay?
And what
because
they are
this,
doing.
What'll happen is a little radio station will make money. But it's not going to make anybody filthy rich.
And in the process, they've destroyed radio. And I think it's unfortunate that kids coming up now don't know, will not know what radio was. Or you know what I mean? There was a time you could turn on the radio and there was some decent stuff on there. Maybe not the greatest, but decent stuff. But the conglomeration of the airways with these big companies have really destroyed it. I mean, here in Columbus, two of the Clear Channel stations, several, they own several here. But I turned one night, there was a high school football game on one station, and I flipped, and there was the same game on another station. So they would rather do that than to give a person like yourself a voice.
Well, they're not going to give anything. The couple of years that Boss Man Wayne made it possible for me to be on the air in Beckley was because, you know, we bought our way into the market. And by we, I don't mean me. I had a sponsor.
Yeah.
But see, by the same token, Juanita, I want to make sure that I'm a little bit measured in my remarks about this, because just as I was having we were having the conversation with Dr. John last night, a local newspaper serves the purpose of meeting local information needs, or at least that's what it's supposed to do.
Right.
And so, one of the most enjoyable things I ever did, and I'm pretty sure I did it poorly, was to serve as color commentary for my high school's football team for a season. It was a delight. And you know what? Little local radio stations need to be running the basketball team, the local high school team, the local high school basketball, football, baseball, because it's not just that you're providing some sort of glory for the young local athletes. It's also that you are bringing up the next generation of talent, okay? I mean, yes. I'm sitting here right now because a somewhat cynical man who owned a Christian radio station in Northwest Alabama decided that I was worth paying $3.35 an hour to for 25 hours a week, 31 hours a week at $3.35 an hour to read the news, spin some truly, truly awful gospel wax, and sit quietly while the board caught fire from time to time. It really did. I'm not kidding. The engineer said, don't you leave the building, and if it starts to burn, don't spray it with the fire extinguisher. I'll be right there. That was the night the board caught fire. Hey! The board's on fire. It's all right. I'm on the way. That doesn't exist anymore. In very few instances does that exist anymore. I mean, even that little gospel radio station had a newsroom. And we had a guy who would sit there clacking away on an electric typewriter writing up news copy for the news breaks in the morning, which were 5 minutes long. And in the evenings, I was, 5 minutes, read the news, top of the hour.
Well, you know, that's what I mean when I say that kids coming up now may not get to experience great radio in a way that you and I understand, you know, the medium, what it was. And I think that's very sad. I mean, but, you know, the same goes with newspapers. I think it's a tragedy that newspapers are going down like that.
And yet, notice what Scott in Sweden said at the beginning of the program. Little Stockholm of only 2 million people has 5 dailies.
Well, I think, Bob, that, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but I really think that once newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post and people, when journalists started to use the Rupert Murdoch model of news, I think really people who really like news turned away. I mean, I would not subscribe to the New York Times now.
Well, I mean, the sad thing is, you can even, God, there's so many places to begin to analyze the problem, and I look at it particularly from the radio standpoint, Juanita. Those 5 minutes of news that I read at the top of every hour as the little pimply-faced DJ?
Right.
That was because the boss was too cheap to bring in a satellite radio or a trunk line radio news service, okay, where they would have some professional read the news, so the pimply-faced kid read it instead and became fairly good at it.
Right.
I was much better at it then than I am now. I was paying attention to my diction. I didn't say I said I, and I didn't say get, I said get. My diction was much better back then. But anyway, those five minute news blocks were there at the top of the format clock, and the 2.5 minutes at the bottom of the format clock, because the FCC, job killing regulations, right?
Right.
The FCC maintained a requirement that anyone holding a radio license to broadcast upon the airwaves that were owned by the people of the United States of America, all of us in common, Commonwealth.
Right, right.
That if you were granted the privilege of owning a license to do that, that you owed something back to the people that you were broadcasting to, besides selling them free car wash with fill-up at Freddy's Texaco on Fridays.
Yeah, and now you can't get the time or the weather.
And so now the top-of-the-hour news that used to be one of the gems in CBS and ABC and, once upon a time, NBC radios, I don't even know if they still exist, and CNN's, because that's where I worked, Crown, is now a one-minute blurb with 2 minutes of commercials around it.
Yep.
And I was taught to write news stories that were no longer than 20 seconds. That's 3 news stories tops. No matter if the world is falling apart, okay? And so, the only thing left is NPR. And the people who, the right wingers, well, that's liberal. Well, as a liberal, as a progressive, I can tell you it's not.
No, it's not. As a matter of fact, our local NPR station here, it used to be really good. And again, the right wing sort of demanded that it was too liberal, and they really ruined a wonderful show. And at that time...
Well, Talk of the Nation is now gone from NPR? NPR actually had... And for instance, if you live in West Virginia, and you've probably heard NPR in West Virginia, Juanita... If you live in West Virginia, you think that NPR is nothing but classical music that's fit only for playing in funeral homes with the news blocks in the morning and the evening.
Yeah.
It's deadly dull. I mean, it's terrible. And the guy who runs West Virginia Public Radio says, and it'll never be any different either, by God. But NPR actually had, for instance, Nashville, Tennessee had an FM and an AM NPR. And the AM was just full of awesome talk programming. Even if you disagreed with the guy who did Talk of the Nation, it was still delivered in such a way as to be thought-provoking.
I agree.
And it's gone now.
It's gone. But I don't know how we'll get the media back if I just don't know. I think the Telecommunications Act of 1996 definitely.
Well, and see, you're on the money, Juanita, because that is the problem. Just like seeing some progressive write about our democracy at this point in time, I'm so frustrated and I've so run out of tolerance and patience that I just tear at my hair and run screaming into the night, and Agnes has to come out and chase me down with a butterfly net and a beer. It's okay, honey. Settle down. We won't read that word anymore. Not because I hate democracy, but because if you think that we've got one, you're just, you know, it's like starting math with 2 plus 1 equals 12. You know, you're not going to get anywhere. Assuming that there's anything democratic about the United States is just a non-starter. It's you know, this way, you know, this way lies madness. But anyway, by the same token, a lot of progressives say, well, you know, if we only brought back the fairness doctrine, and that's another one that sends me screaming out into the night. Can you imagine a fairness doctrine? Because, you know, once you start monkeying with something like that, they're not going to be happy just to put it back the way it was. It's going to have to be new and improved, and maybe we'll bring the Internet within the purview. And then all of a sudden, if somebody drops an F-bomb on the horn, I'm into $675,000 worth of fines.
Yes.
You see? And let's extend the fairness doctrine to the Internet, too. Let's make sure there's an equal and opposing viewpoint to everything that gets said on this program for 3 hours so we can find some, hey, maybe I can give a job to give 3 hours to the right-wing nut job over in Beckley. Save me, Jesus, from the fairness doctrine. But you're absolutely right, Juanita. The 1996 Telecommunications Act, thanks, Bill, is what really did us in, because that's what created the ability for media ownership, whether it be newspaper, radio, and TV, or TV, to all be sort of conglomerated, to press down and shaken together, like the good book says, into one big hateful lump that's owned by six corporations.
And just as that act was passed here in the United States, one similar was being passed in Great Britain. And so, you know, what did we have in common with them? Well, Rupert Murdoch. And so the only thing that Rupert Murdoch wasn't successful in doing in Great Britain that he's been successful with doing here is he did not destroy Ofcom, which is like their FCC. But he was about to get Tony Blair to do that when the scandal really took hold of the hacking scandal. So,
yeah.
So, but anyway, I'm going to let you go, Bob. And the thing about the racism and the whole thing, I still believe that the reason why people are doing these blatant acts of racism, like the gigantic Confederate flag, is they feel emboldened because they are being instigated and encouraged and justified by politicians.
Sure.
They are being, I mean, this is, you know, and the media never calls them on it. I mean, if we have laws on discrimination and so forth, then why aren't you calling these politicians who have used that?
Right. You know, this business in Virginia, for instance.
With the tanning.
Well, no. In Virginia, the business with the giant Confederate flag.
Yeah.
What would happen? Because, you know, our interstates are nothing more than commercial zones. It's a bunch of more or less scenery. And, you know, I hate interstates anymore. They're very efficient for delivering goods, but whenever I can, I get off the beaten. And it's not because I'm older. It's just because I like seeing stuff, and I like historical markers, and I like stopping along the way. I've decided I'm not going to hurry anymore anywhere. Because there's too much to be learned. But the interstates are just commercial spaces, and everywhere there's an exit, you know, there's a Cracker Barrel and a Bob Evans and a Chili's and an Applebee's and 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 10 Rippy Marts with a Taco Bell in them or a Subway. They are commercial zones. Now, we're talking about a flagpole, a 50-foot. We're going to erect a 50-foot pole. Hoo-wee! Maybe a letter-writing campaign, you know, some enterprising soul who knows where that's going to take place goes and contacts all the businesses within a five-mile radius and says, "Dear sirs, we will be beginning a campaign encouraging people not to do business with you because you're near that thing." Now, you get that thing. You're part of the business community here. You can go to the Chamber of Commerce. You can go to the County Commission. You get that filthy thing taken down, or you go broke.
Yes.
You pick, because it's a absolutely free market, right? Well, here's the unseen hand delivering you the letter.
And that seems to be the only thing that you can't appeal to their, you know, their better angels, as they say.
Yeah, Lincoln got shot for that.
Yep. So, well, that's, I don't know, Bob. I get so discouraged sometimes.
Well, you get discouraged, I get disgusted. You know, in the chat room, Juanita, when I was suggesting that there needed to be a Confederate flag burning somewhere near that flagpole every day, mm-hmm. I was corrected. The chat room's really good for that. Lottie pointed out that burning a flag is an honorable way to dispose of a flag that has become too damaged to be useful any longer. And what there needs to be is a Confederate flag stomping every day.
That's
grind the filthy thing into the dirt.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, I told you, Bob, that I moved in my present place because my next-door neighbor had Confederate flags all over his wall and was loaded to the teeth. So, you know, I had been there for 11 years, and he just got really crazy here in the last 3 years, and I thought, oh, guys. When I saw the big assault rifle coming in the, you know, coming in the place, I thought, oh, it's time to go.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Okay, Bob, take care.
Well, Juanita, you have yourself a lovely evening.
To the calls tonight. Not much, but maybe it'll help a little.
Oh, it always does. It always does. Thank you, Juanita. I appreciate it. You have a good evening.
You too.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
And the fact of the matter is, that's Juanita calling from Ohio. The fact of the matter is, our next-door neighbor. And how do I respond to this? Our next-door neighbor has decided to fly a Confederate battle flag by the side of the road. What do you do? I mean, does that impose an obligation on me to fly the American flag so that everybody will understand that we're not treasonous? Because understand, if you are flying that flag, you are endorsing the treason committed by the people who marched and killed under it. Not were killed, killed. And it's about damn time we had an understanding about that. So I don't know. Do I have to go? We got a 50-foot. We're erecting a 50-foot pole. You know, I looked at Agnes and I said, "You know, look down there." And she says, "Shut up, Bob. Look the other way. Don't start anything." My beloved Agnes has right good sense. But that's a slap in the face. That filthy thing is a slap in the face. Well, just 2 miles away, there's a little veterans memorial, and it's not a Confederate veterans memorial. It's not a Civil War veterans memorial. It starts with the Spanish-American War and comes forward, and we can have plenty of discussions about the Spanish-American War, about whether we should have been in the First World War. But they were people serving honorably, they're serving their country honorably. And there's a great big American flag that flies over that thing. And while I understand that, we smart people, we live in a gray world. There's nuance to everything. The universe is nothing but nuance. But given a choice between the flag of your nation and the flag of a bunch of treasonous bastards, which one are you going to stand under? No, I'm not going to queue up Lee Greenwood or anything. No, not by any stretch of the imagination. What I'm going to do is go back to the phones. Thank you, Juanita. Thank you very much. Between Juanita and Michael and Sal, we're getting there. We need 23. We need 23 more folks at $10 apiece, and we're on level ground going forward. Thank you kindly. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's your favorite godless atheist in Louisiana stand, Jim.
Hey, Jim, what's happening? Glad you're holding the ground.
Oh, all right, man. That whole Southern thing. It just, you know, I'll get to the other point. That just reminds me back, like when I was a young whippersnapper in my teens, growing up. The new quote unquote genre of music was that crap, that Southern rock. You know, be proud you're a rebel because the South's
gonna do it again.
I just hated it. I just hated it. You know, from the get go, I just never. Sometimes the whole theme is proud to be stupid.
Yeah, you know, that's why I love the drive-by truckers so much. They are the direct antithesis of all of that. They're about as Southern as you can get, and they've completely blurred the lines between country and just, you know, grinded out Southern rock. But the lyrics, oh no. No, it's a whole nother kettle of fish when you get to the lyrics.
Well, the whole thing, the whole Southern plantation mentality. Oh, but unless you're, it's even worse than the 1% now. Unless you're at the very top, it ain't. I mean, the only reason it's kind of good for you is because you're not at the bottom, right?
Yeah, there, but for the yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you're the slave master, but you're still just barely getting by. But at least you're not a slave. It's just incredible. Speaking of that, I remember one of you, I got like a little thing. It's like one of your favorite congressmen or whatever. It's a combination of what they were saying. They don't have enough money for King Crab.
Oh, Louie.
Why don't they just get a tanning bed? What are they going to do about a tanning bed? Why are they worrying about a tanning bed, you know?
Leave it to you.
Well, I heard that the other day. I'm thinking they're worried about a tanning bed, but they're crying about not having enough money for King Crab.
You know, you can cook him king crabs in your tanning bed. they get more orange color than they do pink, but they cook right up.
Yeah, it's
just do the drawn butter right there beside it.
Yeah, well,
give the lobster, give the and you can give the king crabs or the lobsters whatever those little dark glasses so their little buggy eyes won't get. You know, anything that you lay in and you have to wear welder's glasses to keep from frying your eyeballs. I'm guessing it's not a good idea.
Well, I mean, you saw that woman who just over-tanned herself to, for whatever. It was all over the internet, cable, the tan, you know, got in trouble for trying to put her daughter in the tanning bed or something a couple of months ago. But anyway, did you see the new thing, the JFK book about the new premise is basically that JFK was accidentally shot by the Secret Service or something?
No. What?
I heard that at the top of the news a couple of days ago, or you know, I guess suggested.
Really? It. Really? The great horrifying event that proved to be the pivot point for all of American culture for 50 years was an oopsie?
That's kind of the new story, and then what I was thinking when I heard that was, well, what another great reason for privatization, because surely if you had privatized guys doing it, it wouldn't have happened. But, yeah, I heard that somewhere on the radio or on the internet. I,
I'm going to have to go read that.
I think it was on, what's that, that show that comes on early in the morning on Monday through Friday with the former congressman.
Yeah, the guy who oopsied his beautiful congressional aide.
Yeah. And
you got to wonder if anybody. I guess you lose your job at NBC if he's walking by and you put up like you're making it about ready to sneeze.
It probably isn't a good career decision move, you know. And you know, and then with the way jobs are looking at the newspapers, you don't want to be looking anywhere else. So, yeah, but I mean, that's, I don't know. I mean, I guess you and I just tend to see things a little bit differently, you know. I mean, and that's the other weird thing. Sometimes you try and talk to people about it. These can be relatively intelligent people. But they just go along with the corporate party line. So I guess is that, you know, you just keep your secret reality thoughts to yourself and whistle a happy tune to get by. Is that the way it works now?
Well, that, I mean, people have various, shall we say, coping strategies. Some of them are measured by proof.
Okay. And then maybe breaking into a couple of verses of I don't want to be a pinhead no more.
Yeah, well, that too.
Okay.
And, you know, me, I get my exercise by running screaming into the yard and being chased by Agnes with a butterfly net.
I hear you. All right, Bob, well, let me let you go. Let somebody else on. I just wanted to check that out about that.
Well, I will.
Those new solution to supposedly it was like the one in security and allegedly shot him. I don't know. I guess they were guarding him or something from the rooftop or something, or over by the. They just happened to be over by the grassy knoll. I guess I guess that's what they.
It was a knoll stroll.
Yeah. All right, I'll let you go, Bob.
Jim, you have a good night. Bye now. Jim calling from Louisiana. About 17 minutes before the hour. I want to go. The thing's had a day or so to percolate around, and it's another one of those deeply disturbing national security invading your privacy, taking the Fourth Amendment out behind the barn, and you know, doing it in with an old hickory stick stories. This one being the story, what is it, SOD? S-D-O, SOD? It's a Drug Enforcement Administration unit that gathers information on human beings and then dummies up charges and then, let's see. Federal agents are trying to recreate an investigative trail to effectively cover up where the information originated. And the information originates... According to a Reuters story, when law enforcement agents use intelligence, intel intercepts, wiretaps, informants, and, yes, a huge computer database of telephone records to help them launch criminal investigations. And it almost always has to do with drugs. SOD, yeah, the Special Operations Division of the DEA. And there are 24 partner agencies inside SOD, the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, the Internal Revenue Service, the Department of Homeland Security, among others. It's been banging around since 1994. It was put out there as part of the war on... Wait a minute. Let's do this right. War on drugs! Which, of course, has never done any good whatsoever for the United States of America or the sovereign people thereof. It is, of course, classified. How Reuters dug this up, I do not know. But they have reviewed documents, and basically it's a matter of using unfair tactics, improper tactics, arguably unconstitutional tactics, to gin up information, yielding a drug bust, and then going backwards and having the officers who ran the bust recreate a plausible methodology whereby the drug bust was accomplished. Okay? One document presented to agents reads, according to Reuters, "Remember that the utilization of sod cannot be revealed or discussed in any investigative function." And it's kind of like Fight Club. The first rule of sod is don't talk about sod. Agents are taught how, having used sod, to then turn around and use, quote, normal investigative techniques to recreate the information provided by sod, unquote. Sounds a little Byzantine and bizarre. The Department of Justice, of course, which runs the DEA, had no comment. But this comes from the Reuters story. But two senior DEA officials defended the program and said trying to recreate an investigative trail is not only legal, but a technique that is used almost daily. A former federal agent in the northeastern United States who received such tips from SOD described the process. Quote, "You'd be told only be at a certain truck stop at a certain time and look for a certain vehicle. And so we'd alert the state police to find an excuse to stop that vehicle and then have a drug dog search it. After an arrest was made, agents then pretended that their investigation began with the traffic stop, not with the sod tip," the former agent said. The training document reviewed by Reuters refers to this process as parallel construction. Bear with me. A dozen current or former federal agents interviewed by Reuters confirmed that they had used parallel construction during their careers. Most defended the practice, you know, because they got a paycheck for doing it. Some said they understood why those outside law enforcement might be concerned. All right. If you want to go and read up on the whole thing, I encourage you to. It's a good idea to have a working understanding of the present status of the Bill of Rights, in particular, one's right to be secure in one's person, papers, and effects, per the Fourth Amendment. But if one would understand this process, this program, and if one would, you know, remember, it was put in place in 1994, if one would, having learned of this program, say, see, that Obama, that Kenyan Muslim with the deep-seated hatred of white people, is going to round us all up using the sod program and put us in the FEMA Regi-Regi education camps. I'll meet you over by the guard tower on the southwest side and be selling cigarettes. And my point in saying that is that we are... cursed is not the right word. We are bedeviled by our lack of knowledge. Because people seem to think that all of this NSA stuff, this DEA stuff, the FBI stuff, is somehow new. There has never been a moment inside the Federal Bureau of Investigation when their prime motivating directive was not the violation of the Fourth Amendment of the United States. The FBI exists as a counterpoint to the Fourth Amendment of the United States. The FBI is a giant argument that the Fourth Amendment is a bad thing. The FBI only comes into existence after this nation becomes an empire. Okay? But in particular, with regard to this matter of sod, when I first read the story yesterday, somewhere back in on one of my yet fully functioning brain cells, Wait a minute. Parallel construction. What? Recreation? What? And then I realized this has been around for a long time. But we are caught up in a... we're caught up in this thing that says that our freedom's at risk because of... And there is, as I have noted, a long discussion that needs to take place about domestic spying. You know, for instance, that the man who illegally supported the domestic spying program that was initiated in the early aughts, well, he had some socialized medicine done on him today. Who knew that Dim Leader was 67 years old? But in fact, he had a stent put in. All those years of all that BS about how he was our most fit president ever. Not like that goddamn Bill Clinton running around eating Big Macs. No. George W. Bush rides bicycles into walls and rides segways through hedges and runs over Secret Service agents. And, he chops brush. He's a fit and healthy president. Well, our fit and healthy former Dim Leader had himself a stent put in his artery somewhere today at the age of 67. But that's okay. He'll be up and around here in very short order. My medical buddies tell me that he should be able to get back to crawling around on the floor looking for imaginary weapons of mass destruction and making fun of the dead of 4,000 dead in Iraq, and just probably by tomorrow. But the domestic spying program that everybody's having such a purple polka-dotted blue screaming hissy over began under Bush. It really did. True, Marty. Thank you. Who knew that Dim Leader had a heart that would need surgery? Every day I wonder who Dick Cheney had bumped off. You know, how he got himself some Falun Gong heart to keep that manifestation of evil still stalking the planet. But anyway, back to my brief. The idea of recreating a crime scene or recreating a situation so as to construct the solution to a crime in parallel fashion is not new. Little old me and probably little old anybody else who sat through first year criminal law probably had someone who told them about this. And so the telling that was being done to little old me was being done in 1988. Maybe 1989. And it has to do with a rather fascinating and grisly and horrifying Supreme Court case. It's a 1977 court case that has to do with a murder in 1968. The wheels of justice grind slowly. And as noted before, one of the first things they tell you after they let you in to have your cup of coffee in law school, they tell you hard cases make bad law. This is one of those. It's a story out of Des Moines, Iowa. And it's a story of horror and heartbreak that is 45 years old this December. It was Christmas Eve, 1968. And the Powers family had gone together to the local YMCA in Des Moines to watch a wrestling match. Her brother was wrestling in the match, the tournament. At some point in the evening or the day, 10-year-old Pamela Powers went to the restroom and didn't come back. The search was on. Living at that YMCA, there was a man named Robert Williams. Robert Williams had escaped not too long previous from a mental hospital. Shortly after little Pamela Powers disappeared, Williams was seen in the lobby of the local YMCA there in Des Moines carrying some clothing and a big bundle wrapped in a blanket. A 14-year-old boy helped him open the street door to the YMCA so he could get to his car outside. Later on, when interviewed, the little boy said that when he put the bundle in the car, when Williams put the bundle in the car, he saw legs, little legs, sticking out. So the hunt was on. The day after Christmas, with the help of a local lawyer, Williams surrendered himself to police in Davenport, Iowa. And having booked him and charged him, they gave him his Miranda warnings. The Davenport police then called the Des Moines police and said, come get him. The Des Moines police went to do that. And they sent two officers to go and pick Williams up. Both police officers knew that Williams was represented by counsel and had been Mirandized. So they knew that they were forbidden from asking him questions, right? Williams was also, however, mentally unsound. So the cops can't ask him questions, but in the course of the litigation, the following came out. Without ever directly asking a question of this deeply mentally ill, dangerous human being, the police detective began referring to Williams as Reverend Williams. The police detective was Detective Learning. And as they traveled down the road between Davenport, Iowa, and Des Moines, Detective Learning said the following: I want to give you something to think about while we're traveling down the road. Number one, I want you to observe the weather conditions. It's raining. It's sleeting. It's freezing. Driving is very treacherous. Visibility is poor. It's going to be dark early this evening. They're predicting several inches of snow for tonight, and I feel that you yourself are the only person that knows where this little girl's body is. That you yourself have only been there once, and if you get a snow on top of it, you yourself may be unable to find it. And since we will be going right past the area on the way into Des Moines, I feel that we could stop and locate the body that the parents of this little girl so that they could be entitled to a Christian burial for the little girl who was snatched away from them on Christmas Eve and murdered. And I feel we should stop and locate it on the way rather than waiting until morning and trying to come back out after a snowstorm and possibly not being able to find it at all. And so this mentally ill man, and many mentally ill people have fixations regarding religion, and the madman, Williams, was known to have been deeply religious, and that began to prey on his mind. That the little girl that he and his madness had murdered deserved a Christian burial and might never receive it. This is an impulse that goes all the way back in the human psyche to the very first moments when we were human. One of the first things that marks us as human is the fact that we bury our dead. And we put little trinkets and grave goods with them, either for them to carry into the afterlife or as some manifestation of our love for them. I remember a young man who died of cancer many years ago, and before they closed the coffin, his parents slipped a roll of Jolly Ranchers into his hands because he loved them. So the question is, had the cops done something wrong when they knew that this man had been Mirandized? They knew they couldn't ask him questions. And yes, because they preyed upon his mind, he told them where the body was. Hard cases make bad law. It's 1968. And yes, he gives up the location of the body because the deeply religious madman, the religiously insane man, the man whose religion was as much of his insanity as any defective mind was, well, he'd been preyed upon with this Christian burial speech. And of course, his counsel said, this is inadmissible. You can't do this. Praying on an insane man's mind, even you weren't sure, you didn't ask him any questions, you made direct statements, but it still had the same summary effect. You got a confession out of it. And ultimately, the court held that what they did to Robert Williams was A-OK. They ruled this in 1977. Because they said that had they sectioned off a grid pattern, and this is often the way that one searches now for a missing child or a missing anybody, you impose a grid pattern on the place where you think the missing person is, and you get a team of people and you comb over it. And the reasoning, because this is an awful case, are you really going to let a crazy man, a homicidal crazy man who has murdered a 10-year-old little girl on Christmas Eve, are you really going to let him walk? Because of some creative police work? Creative, arguably unconstitutional, knew it was wrong, never should have done it, police work? Well, no, you're not. You're going to create a legal fiction. You're going to create the idea, the protogenesis of the idea of parallel construction that we now know about via what's going on at SOD. You're going to say, well, if they had imposed a grid pattern and everybody had searched it, well, we would have found the body. And the body of the discovery would have been inevitable. And there it is. A little girl murdered on Christmas Eve, 1968. And the parallel construction recreation of the crime argument used as a means of upholding the conviction. This isn't something that started in 1994. It isn't something that started under dim leader. It isn't an Obama problem. Nonetheless, I'm sure that the hue and cry and howling will be, oh, we need to impeach Obama. But this is an erosion of the Fourth Amendment and the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. This isn't Fourth so much as Fifth. The Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination that goes back to 1968. But because so many of us have the analytical faculties, and I don't mean y'all, the analytical faculties of banana slug, we will think, how many people have read this Reuters article and said, well, damn, 1994, that, by God, is when America done come apart and become a fascist state. See, I know that Bill Clinton hated America. All that program that came into effect in 1994 did was to bring into an organizational structure stuff that had been going on nationwide since at least 1968. But we, the people of the United States, not working that hard on creating a more perfect union, not that particularly interested in providing for the common good, overly obsessed with providing for the common defense, well, we weren't paying attention. And now we are shocked, shocked, I tell you, shocked to find out that something that was approved of by the Supreme Court in 1977 has been put on steroids and is running at full throttle. So, I mean, if you read the story about the sod and you're sitting there shocked and disgusted, which I was and am, at least understand that the shock and the disgust has roots that run way back. 77, oh, so that's 30. Yeah. Hey, 36 years. Says something, doesn't it? I'm not going to take a break. No. I'm gonna keep it rolling. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Working through the break. What are you? You work for Bezos now, Bob?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
John, by the way.
Hey, John.
Wow, that was boy, that was fascinating. Even when the topic is pretty unsettling, I do get warm, fuzzy feelings from context. So thanks for that.
Well, thank you, John. I appreciate that very much. And context matters in this case. You know, it was an awful, awful thing, and it would have been manifestly wrong to over. Wouldn't it have been?
Yeah.
I mean, can we say that you know, the cops weren't trying to be crafty? They were trying to find a 10-year-old girl's body on the day after Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And you take something like that, and it turns into a gargantuan assault on the Fourth and Fifth Amendments.
Yeah. These powers they can't be played around with. But you know, it's not new. And I mean, I missed the very first part. Is Greenwald all over this in his ilk?
No. This was actually broken by Reuters, and it's a legitimate, real news story done by real journalists.
Oh, okay, great. Wow. Well, I know that was. I appreciate these moments when you go back, especially in the sort of legal history. Because I, for one, am extraordinarily weak on that, and that was fascinating.
It's nothing that 3 years of sheer living hell in law school won't cure.
I can imagine. I did want to clarify one thing. You said you know, we've been burying our dead as long as we've been human. Neanderthals actually were doing that also.
Yeah, you know, I realized I was screwing up even as I said that, John.
Well, you know, I think it may speak to how much more like us they were than anything else. So not really a correction, just a, you know, let's broaden the family circle a little bit, I guess.
Well, and we're running around with some of their genetics, aren't we?
A good proportion of us who are Northern European, probably so, yeah.
And I don't want to go out there and lean on the Neanderthals or anything, but might it explain a little bit of contrarian behavior?
Well, there maybe is that.
Because I'll never forget my magnificent first anthropology professor, also named John, by the way, who told us in class assembled. He said, "Listen, I could bring Neanderthal man in here, give him a haircut and a shave, and put a business suit on him, and he'd probably get hired at a bank."
Well, that makes you say more about banks than about Neanderthals.
Well, I think that's why I said that.
Exactly. Very nice. Yeah, no, they were a smart bunch. They had some things figured out. But you know, our whole heritage did. No, really, what I wanted to bring up in light of just, you know, lots and lots of just what seems like, you know, depressing news, something really cool is going on up here in upstate New York, and I want to tell folks about it.
Yes.
So they can share. 2013, this is the 400th anniversary of the Two-Row Wampum Treaty.
Yes.
And the Two-Row Wampum Treaty was made by the nations of the Iroquois Confederacy, the Haudenosaunee people, and the original Dutch colonial settlers up here in New York. And it was 1613, and it was an agreement of perpetual friendship and non-interference. And it was called the Two-Row Wampum Treaty because it is symbolized by a wampum belt. And what wampum is these little, very, very pretty purple shell beads that are made out of quahog shells. Very laboriously, meticulously, usually sort of tubular beads that are this striking purple color. And this wampum belt has two rows of purple wampum separated by three rows of white regular old shell beads. And it's a symbol of this agreement of perpetual friendship and peace and non-interference. And this is the 400th anniversary of that. To this day, the Haudenosaunee people think of this as the foundation of all of their interactions with European people up until the present.
Wow. That's
taking the long view, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. And there, I mean, there are still Haudenosaunee people.
Oh, there are quite a few of them. Very, very great numbers. They're not the most populous native community, but they are very vibrant, very strong, and still very much here in upstate New York, in Ontario, and some related folks out in Wisconsin.
Wow.
And yeah, it's pretty fascinating. So what's going on here in sort of honor of this? There's a push, they're calling it the Two-Row Wampum Renewal Campaign, right? And it's just a series of events, and one of them is a big canoe trip down the Hudson River from Albany to New York City. And these are native paddlers and also non-native paddlers. And they're going to be in New York this week on the 9th is when they're going to reach, their little flotilla is going to reach New York, and they're going to appear at the UN in honor of Indigenous Peoples Day. And it's a real fascinating thing. It's a reminder to some folks up here that, yeah, there's still a very strong Native presence in upstate New York. And what's real interesting about this, as you might expect, is that this notion of sort of perpetual peace and friendship and non-interference has a really strong environmental component to it. Something I think you've probably encountered in your dealing with Native folks in other places.
Yes, because there's a recognition that people are not divorced from the world in which they live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed, we're nurtured by it. Yeah, you can't go very far, very long without water and air.
And yeah, right, and inexorably tied to it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so what? There's a very strong environmental overlay to this, and so we have, Native folks up here taking the lead and talking about how, for instance, fracking is something that we can't do. And, in fact, it's just not morally wrong, it's not just economically wrong, but it violates this treaty that the U.S. entered into with the Onondaga people, or the Haudenosaunee people. But they're saying, look, if you guys promise not to interfere with us, and the words of the treaty were, as long as the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, as long as the water flows downhill, as long as the grass grows green, if you made this agreement not to interfere with us, then if you start fracking and ruining our water and land, then you're breaking the laws of this treaty.
Right, and the thing is, when the country was formed under the Constitution, certain treaty obligations were also taken as being incorporated into the workings of the new nation.
Exactly. In fact, the second diplomatic agreement that the U.S. entered into after the Constitution was passed, 1794, the Treaty of Canandaigua in upstate New York, was an agreement with, again, the Haudenosaunee people, and the Two-Row Wampum Treaty was the foundation for that.
Yeah, it was ratified.
Yeah, and it was ratified. Exactly, right. So this is settled law. This is an obligation the United States is bound by law to honor. So I think it's a very interesting approach to stewardship.
I think you're absolutely right, John. And I wanted to draw your attention to something else. I don't know if you're aware of it, but you were the first to bring my and our attention to the problems in Dimmock, PA.
Yeah.
Well, I found a fascinating article over at Truthout last week, mm-hmm. and the headline on it simply says, "Internal EPA presentation reveals dispute over fracking contamination at Dimmock Wells."
Mm-hmm.
And it contains one of the most, you want to talk about a nightmare scenario, it's a low-light photograph of a barn on a country road, and it's massive, and in the background you see these massive flares of methane burning off from a well pad.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking, you know what? I'm guessing there's some greenhouse gases there.
Yeah.
The first time I saw it, I had something tickle in the back of my brain, and I ran back and I watched the opening scenes of Ridley Scott's brilliant Blade Runner.
Oh.
And of course, in that dystopian future, which is supposed to be 2019, mm-hmm. A flying car comes towards you over a darkened, forever twilight Southern California landscape, and periodically these bursts of methane flame shoot up into the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, you know, we don't have the androids yet. You know, the Nexus 6 isn't here yet, but mm-hmm. we're certainly making the landscape right.
Yeah, it sounds like it is. Now, I'll say that I think that report probably picked up from Gasland 2, because that's in that. And he introduces us to a guy who basically plowed his life savings into buying a camera that can record that sort of thing, and took it around to different well sites and took video. And it shows up in the movie. So I'm guessing that that was the genesis of that story.
Well, it comes out of a story in the Los Angeles Times. Basically, the EPA had conflicting data over whether or not the water was poisoned, but it turns out that an internal PowerPoint presentation that comes from the EPA served as a direct warning to people further up the food chain to EPA that more testing had to be done at Dimmock because of the presence of methane, arsenic, and barium that was more than likely related to fracking.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, you know, good on the LA Times for finding it, but what does that, you know, what does that do for the people in Dimmock?
Yeah, well, they were, you know, they were officially told by the EPA that there's nothing wrong with them, and unofficially told, again, this also shows up in Gasland too, unofficially told, yeah, this is what we're saying, but don't drink the water. So there's intimations of a fairly high level cover up at EPA, and this fits in with that. But that really, really raises the idea of, you know, what does stewardship mean? I mean, if you're a gas driller, you're a gas flag. Stewardship means, well, you know, we need to take this land and extract what we can from it. And if you are a rational thinking person, if you're a native person, steeped in the idea of Turtle Island and thinking seven generations forward, your approach to stewardship is something very, very different than that. Land isn't there for...
Well, land, it stands in direct contravention, doesn't it, of the idea that the Dominionists grab hold of, that you know, it is not stewardship, but it is dominion over the land.
Right.
And those are two distinctly separate concepts.
Yeah.
Well, these movements are taking place, and what I find brilliant out of it, John, is that it is being led in many instances by Native peoples. Whether it's the celebration of the two-row wampum treaty, or the Anishinaabe people in northern Wisconsin demanding that the ceded territories that were granted by treaty rights be honored,
mm-hmm.
and it extends all, as you know, all the way up into Canada and dealing with the tar sands
and the Idle No More movement, all that. Yeah,
exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And of course I'm paying attention to citizens concerned about the Pinoki mine on Facebook, and I'm just seeing this really, really brilliant spirit of energy that is driving this. You know, they had one problem where somebody came in and did some semi-violent stuff, and of course the industry turned around and tried to use that to tar the entire struggle. Mm-hmm. I don't think that they've been successful.
Yeah.
But it's well, they're not going away, and they're not going to be run off, because, you know, when you've got treaty rights, you've got something that other people don't have.
Mm-hmm.
Treaties either mean something or they do not. Now, of course, this country does have a long and dishonorable history of violating treaties with Native peoples.
Mm-hmm.
But one would hope, what you see is that after we violated a bunch of treaties in the more modern era, there has been a movement toward actually recognizing their validity. And nothing would please me more than seeing that band of out of control hillbillies get smacked right in the face with the treaty in Wisconsin, and have the same thing happen to the people who want to. I mean, what a weird concept to rape the water, and I'm uncomfortable even using the word rape anymore. But to devastate, to destroy, to negate, mm-hmm. you know, the one thing that we can't get along without.
Yeah,
along with and, you know air.
And air, right? But yeah, and of course, again, I don't want to. You never want to romanticize a group of people, but there is definitely a different mindset or ethos when you are taught by your culture to think, you know, not just a year down the line or 10 years down the line, but seven generations down the line. In contrast, that with when you're taught by your culture to think ahead to the next quarterly report, you know, the next board of directors meeting, the next shareholders meeting. And I think one of those is just inherently a bit more moral.
Has that developed if the seven generations rule is in place?
Yeah. Vastly differently.
That's not to say it doesn't develop, but, you know, the concepts of land ownership, the broad form deed that dispossessed so many people in this region, probably some of my kin in one way or another. I mean, after all, that chunk of land where that mine disaster took place was owned by my multi-great-grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he owned it by stealing it. Everything's different. Everything changes. Yeah. And no, I think you're right when you say that. When you say that we don't want to romanticize a people, and you don't want to romanticize an idea.
Yeah.
But our problem lies in the fact that we have not. It's not that we've romanticized it. If we've romanticized and fetishized anything, we've romanticized and fetishized limitless consumption.
Yeah.
And unrestricted consumerism, unrestricted. Capitalism, and as Dr. Bill was talking about just this afternoon, you know, things like public service commissions and regulation of railroads and the entire administrative structure of the executive branch arose out of the fact not that there was some pressing need to jump in there and regulate, but because industry itself had proven itself untrustworthy. And Dr. Bill specifically cited patent medicines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, these capitalist entrepreneurs were killing people.
Mm-hmm. Great example. Yeah.
Now, I guess, shall we assume that the Rand Pauls of the world would be just fine with that? That they wish we could go back to those days?
Well, sure, because the free market would take care of it. You know, if enough people once enough people die, then the market will decide that that is not a good product to have on the market. Of course, what they can't really get their heads around is that, you know, what's the number of people that have to die before that decision is made? And I would prefer to have no people die before that decision is made.
Right. And what proof, because the argument about, you know, the free market will correct that, is there any empirical proof of that being true, John? Or is all the proof in exactly the opposite direction? That given the ability to run wild, capitalism will run wild.
Well, I don't know that there's any empirical proof, because that sort of fetishized free market really has never existed. I mean, outside of what is it, Sandra has noted, Haiti and Somalia.
Right.
We'll put those aside. It's never really existed because it's so unworkable. So I don't know if it's ever really existed, but if you look at the sort of laws of motion of capitalism, then in a perfect free market, no, it wouldn't correct itself, because the only motivation is to increase profit. There's no secondary motivation, not for health, not for well-being, and not even to really serve a market. A market doesn't have to be served. As long as you're making profit, you're doing what capitalism teaches you. So I'd say no.
Well, it certainly does seem to be the case, because for the life of me, I can't remember an industry that went out of business because the free market sorted out. I mean, okay, in the little town where I grew up, before the advent of the automobile, there had been a factory that made buggies. Mm-hmm. And in fact, working in the free market, the buggy factory went out of business with the rise of the automobile.
Right.
But that's not because the buggy was rejected as being unsafe or unsound, or no, that was just the market advancing.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Technological change, that always happens.
Sure.
Right, and I mean the example of sort of the electric car, you know, in that great documentary, you know, that's not a perfect free market because there was so much money and influence and persuasion in behind the internal combustion engine. In a perfect free market, it would have had a perfect an equal opportunity to compete. But that never happened, and the list goes on and on for things like that.
Well, it's kind of interesting to see President Obama making some rather snarky remarks about the Keystone XL pipeline.
Yeah.
You'd like to hope that leads to a refusal of it, but I'm also politically cynical, and if that refusal comes on January the 19th, 2017. And the new guy or woman coming in goes, no, approved. Well, what does it matter? Or John, do you think there's a sense in there that if you delay it long enough, they'll just walk away from it? Because there's another one of those free market things. I've never seen the oil industry walk away from anything.
No, I don't think so. I guess the idea of maybe delay might be that it becomes unprofitable to move that sludge. But then at some point it'll just become profitable again, that ebb and flow again of the market.
Oh, and did you see the outcome, but the follow-up to the pipeline that burst in Arkansas?
No, I didn't see it.
Okay, this is fascinating. It was determined that the pipeline was actually incorrectly installed, that the flaws that led to the failure of the pipeline in 2013 actually were seeded when the thing was put in the ground in 1943.
Jeez.
And conveniently, the next line that I read was, and the company, you know, Amalgamated Foundry of Canton, Ohio, or whatever it was, went out of business a long, long time ago. Too bad. And Exxon said, see, it wasn't our fault.
Right. No accountability whatsoever.
None.
With the implication being that, oh, well, if we did it today, you know, it would be much better.
But precisely.
Absolutely not true. And as we know, you know, there's a built-in failure rate for fracking wells, for instance, and I'm sure for pipeline construction as well. You know, 5% fail at once and 100% fail within 50 years. You know, and failure means, okay, we'll get methane and benzene and all kinds of disgusting things leaking into groundwater.
Yeah, hey, Mama, why does the water taste funny?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. Well, thanks for letting me talk. Let me just plug Dr. Bill real quick.
Please do.
Thoroughly enjoying his shows and his programs, and it's absolutely worth folks' time. Just very informative, very interesting, and he's doing a great job.
And next week is an excellent opportunity to do a little, play a little catch up, because he'll be on the air at 3 o'clock tomorrow as opposed to 4. But next week he's on the road, so we'll play. I don't know. I think I'm probably going to go back and play Friday, yesterday, and today, because the you know how populism started, how populism got killed, how it was replaced by progressivism, and how a whole lot of progressive ideas were just captive ideas of the moneyed elite. Well, my eyes crossed, John.
Well, it was in the story of how that what they were going for originally was a union between rural farmers and urban working people. I mean, that how profound would that have been? Talk about how would history have been different, you know, if that had been able to work, if these two labor segments had been able to unify, boy, that would have been something.
And wasn't a key part of that the fact that was it timber workers where laborers were admitted regardless of race? That there was, you know, there was an egalitarian non-racial element to it, and when you find out about that, you go, oh yeah, that really had to go.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there was something similar with railroad workers also. I could be wrong about that, but yeah, that's the most threatening thing imaginable. Unity, crossing lines of race and class and gender, and boy, that frightens the bosses more than anything else. So that had to go.
Well,
yeah, absolutely fascinating.
I'm glad you're enjoying it, and I appreciate the plug because, as with other things, it carries a little bit more weight, I think, when it's someone who is listening as opposed to me who's sitting here producing.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Bob. Well,
thank you, John. You have yourself a wonderful evening. It's good to hear from you.
Yeah, you too. All right, take care.
All right, bye now. Dr. John, calling from New York, and onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi there, Bob. This is Chris from Nanaimo.
Oh, hey, Chris. Thanks for your patience.
No problems. I just wanted to let you know. Remember when the CIA was trying to find Osama bin Laden and they used the polio vaccination program to do it, and now polio vaccination is basically ceased in Afghanistan and Pakistan, where it's the last holdout?
Yes.
You might remember how just about anybody with any medical training or any kind of ethics sort of was gnashing their teeth and rending their garments over that one.
Absolutely.
Security professionals, Anonymous, and lots of other people are really pissed off with somebody, we don't know who, possibly, if it's a Tesla, go away. You need to go to the potty? Okay. No? So much for coherence.
I understand.
Anyways, a lot of the technical professionals and security professionals are really pissed off because of that gentleman, the Rolling Stones contributing editor, Jenkins, Richards, something like that, died in that fiery car crash a little while ago.
Yes.
Well, because of the conspiracy theories, or possibly the actual reason for the event, a certain professor at, or team of professors at UC San Diego gave a speech, and there's been lots of follow-up, and other professors talking about it, and it's sort of taken the cork out of something, sort of like how the triggers on nuclear bombs were published in Arabic, translated from the Iraqi seized documents when the Republican teabaggers demanded they be published so that they could scrutinize them for the obvious links to Osama bin Laden and such.
Right.
Well, a lot of people have been aware of this for a long time. Well, actually, very, very few people have been aware of this for a very long time and didn't want anyone talking about it because we haven't found a solution yet. And basically what we're worried about is a virus transmitted by car to car in traffic. Turns out they've confirmed quite a bit of stuff that we knew about and that we've had tests on, that cars are really easy to hack. In a Prius, there's something like 16 separate computers, half of which are exposed to what they call an available surface to get at them. And it's very easy to develop. Unfortunately, it's stupidly easy to develop. And this guy did an entire PowerPoint presentation on YouTube, no less, on how you would go about doing it. Hacking into a car by about 8 different methods he knew. We know of a few more, but he didn't mention those. He just said, as sort of an aside, there are others. Yes, it's a kitty dolly. Anyways, he's basically opened the floodgates on someone developing one of these damn things one day and we having a Carmageddon.
Where
a
the...
virus transmitted car to car through Bluetooth or anything else. There's all kinds of ways to get into them, physical and wireless, especially the new cars. The newer the car, the more vulnerable it is. But even the older cars, you know, anything in the 90s, has enough computer access points that literally you could have cars hacking each other as they drive down the street. And say 5 days from now, every car's brakes cease to work, and once you go over 50 kilometers an hour, we just turn off the brake, we turn on the accelerator to max, and just see you. Everybody across the country, a timed attack, what they call a Cron virus, one of the first viruses ever developed, was a Cron virus. This is a scenario we're not happy about. We're really, really upset that it got the press.
Well, I mean, wasn't one of the selling points, Chris, of General Motors OnStar the fact that if your car was stolen, they could disable the car and locate the car?
Yep. That control works in all kinds of ways. It's good if you're missing your car. It's bad if, and this guy showed it, you can literally just hack the car without ever having sight unseen, hack the car, open it for the thief, and drive it away, sight unseen. And with the Google cars, that adds the extra bonus of driving it away without a driver, which would tend to attract attention. You have to have some sort of Men in Black scenario with an inflatable guy in it or something, I guess. But
I'm looking here at the report on Hastings crash, Michael Hastings. And the
invisible, Bob. The thing is,
the so-called eyewitness says, I was just coming northbound on Highland, and I seen a car going really fast. I had no idea people talk like we talk in West Virginia. I was just coming northbound on Highland, and I seen a car going really fast, and all of a sudden I seen it jackknife. I just seen parts fly everywhere, and I slammed on my brakes and stopped and tried to call 911.
Yep, and that's as fast as it happens. But imagine having this thing trigger for a rush hour one day on the East Coast, and just migrates across the country. Or it just happens all at once on a Friday evening. We can't defend the cars from this because we've tried putting firewalls and antiviruses and anti-root kits into all these computers, and they don't have the horsepower. It's like running it on a 286. You just don't have the horsepower to defend it against credible threats.
And, I mean, is that basically what it is? I mean, these are little bitty computers. I mean, we're not talking about running quad cores or core i7s or anything like that, are we?
Nope. Just tiny little industry computers. They haven't got the horsepower your 386 did.
I'm getting a question in from Isaac. You have to be in the car, though? You have to be able to get at the car to hack in it? You can't necessarily do it remotely?
Physical access makes it a world of easy. It adds up about 20 or 30 different access points. Wirelessly, you've got about 5. And attempts to turn it off don't work. You hurt your back. Then don't hurt your back, dear.
And so just to sort of bend back around to what you were saying at the beginning, if you were worried about something like this, and by the same token, we had created a situation whereby, polio broke out and devastated populations in, say, Afghanistan and Pakistan, you get into the tide of retribution.
Well, what I'm worried about is backlash against the green community, who's been anti-car for a while. And two, if you have a modern car, not one of these old rusty Chevys, get yourself a kill switch, just like the electric cars have. Turns off everything. That's the only, you notice, hey, my brakes don't work and I'm accelerating furiously. Try the brakes again, try the emergency brake, and if that doesn't work, it'd be really nice to have a big red button of doom you could push. Or a choke you could pull, or something.
Well, wasn't that one of the early additions to the invention of the railroad locomotive, the dead man switch?
Dead man switch.
Yeah.
But don't let it be run by a computer, because that can be bypassed, too. A nice, big, mechanical dead man switch that can't be hacked. I'm serious, Bob. There's not a computer on this planet somebody can't get into if they just want to.
Well, no. I mean, Chris, that goes hand in hand with the, better mousetrap, better mouse, and better locksmith, better burglar.
Well, we hadn't considered until someone in a chat somewhere mentioned the opportunity for a cascade failure, and then all of a sudden all the lines went dead, and everybody was very quiet and not wanting to talk about it anymore because it was dreadful.
Well, that's one of the things that I do sit around thinking about, because I'm I have no technical background in all of this, but. Within the overall universe of stuff that we've learned about what the NSA is doing, like I said, I like to turn things on its edge and find, and see if it looks differently. And I'm vastly more concerned about the capitalist data acquisition than I am, frankly, the government. And you know, everything, Chris, everything, whether it's, you know, it's not just that they're reading your email, it's that they own it. And as a consequence, we sometimes fetishize the fascinating amount of stuff that you can find on the internet. But what?
Well, I know there's a crew.
What's the permanency of it? What happens? I mean, what kind of redundancy is built into, say, Yahoo or Google's or AOL's email servers?
Well, the thing that I was going to extend it to a larger issue is I'm about a month back on my podcast, and I'm just catching up with the issues of that general that leaked that Stuxnet was a American-produced virus to the press.
Yeah.
Now that the press guy is now being prosecuted just like Greenwald might be, and how that press guy is not being treated the same way Greenwald is and what have you. But the real issue is, you know, the Americans were responsible for Stuxnet, a virus dedicated to attacking industrial machinery, not just nuclear power plants, but anyone that uses those control systems like chemical plants, sewage treatment plants, any kind of thermal plant you can imagine. Maybe that Texas massacre, that horrible explosion, was due to the Stuxnet. You don't know. You can't know. And nobody's probably looking for it, other than the fact that they were holding too much material. But holding too much material is just, it's a prudence thing. It's not an actual causal agent. Maybe the causal agent was...
Well, that's market dynamics too, Chris.
Mm.
You've got too much ammonium nitrate because the market fell out for ammonium nitrate.
Need more Timothy McVeighs out there.
Well, see, I mean, I sat there watching the plant in West Texas and the horror that it was, and I go back to what my good friend Bo Webb says. When that happened, that was a horrible, horrible accident. But when the same quantities of that toxic filth are detonated here in our communities, it's intentional and it's done for a profit.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll slow you down if you know the Deepwater Horizon disaster was an accident. What happened in Arkansas, the pipeline I was talking about with Dr. John, it was an accident. There, and the, you know, like Dr. John mentioned with the failure rates, you know, 50 years, it's 100%. But what's being done here, again, is intentional and done for profit. And that's frightening in its own right. Because if you've got things that are being done intentionally, then what happens when an accident occurs when where the intentional stuff is being done? How hard is that going to be to sort through?
You mean like a Microsoft upgrade or an OnStar upgrade that goes through the cell network to upgrade OnStar's onboard or whatever, and it accidentally causes a problem? Yeah, we've been thinking about that too.
Right.
All of a sudden your accelerator just works entirely too well and your brakes not at all, and we couldn't figure out why, but we're sure it'll be covered in our user agreement.
I was reading something somewhere the other day. I forget... I think it was Chuck Yeager, maybe. When he was, maybe I'm wrong, but the analogy applies. He said it was John Glenn. It was John Glenn going up in the first spacecraft, the first American orbit of the Earth. He said, as I rode into orbit, I thought, you know what? Everything in this space capsule was built by the lowest bidder. And that's sobering. So, you know, is it an accident when something goes wrong with something that was basically made wrong because people were pinching pennies for the sake of the quarterly profit and loss statement? Is that an accident, or is that a triumph of capitalism, Chris?
You got a better system, I'm all yours, but for now we're kind of stuck with it because nobody can, you know, it's that whole how much can you think about it one time? There's so much going wrong that they've literally got us all bamboozled. Is that the appropriate term? You know, give somebody enough things to think about. It's old sales terms like, oh, think about the wipers. Oh, think about the wheels. Think about the car. Don't mind the horrible engine sound. No, that's communism. Think about the wonderful paint. Think of how the women will look at you in it. You know, and just distract them with all the extra features. I mean, the computer salespeople have been doing it for years now.
Sure.
And maybe it's just, you know, Nancy Pelosi, when they first got into power, they introduced like 100 bills in 100 minutes or some silliness like that. And it got the Republicans completely flummoxed because they couldn't address it. It was too fast. Even their news cycle couldn't keep up with the instant outrage, one after another. Just do it, be done with it, and get it over with. Have it ready ahead of time and get it all passed in about 5 minutes by some big ombudsman bill or whatever. But, omnibus bill, pardon me.
Yeah.
And, maybe the right wing has finally figured out from that and others that they can do the same damn thing. They just have to be even more evil. Literally, the doubling down is a viable psychological tactic. If you're just evil enough, people are so worried on one particular evil that they can't address the greater evil that you're perpetrating or all of them.
Well, and you know, that's that, right, Chris, and that was kind of my thesis in trying to bring people, bring people, oh, please, my ego, but trying to bring up a little bit of awareness of this, the case of the little girl and Christmas Eve and Iowa, and the fact that, you know, something that happened on December 24th, 1968 has repercussions that are reverberating down a generation now. And it's because, it's Christmas Eve 1968. What were most of the people on the so-called left thinking about on Christmas Eve 1968? They were thinking about Vietnam. Some of them were thinking about women's rights. A lot of people had been absolutely horrified by the previous year with the deaths of Bobby Kennedy and of Dr. King. And we had swamp water up to our chins of evil stuff. And a little girl disappears out of the bathroom of the Des Moines, Iowa YMCA. And 45 years later, we find out that the legal argument that was made in the follow-up case to the case I was talking about that said inevitable discovery means it was okay to violate the guy's rights on the first go-through, and boom, inevitable discovery becomes parallel discovery, becomes recreate the crime, becomes a massive data mining enterprise in the war on drugs. And the general degradation of everything from the Fourth Amendment to the Fifth Amendment to the Sixth Amendment. So your point is very well taken.
Bob, I'm convinced that there's been so much direct put on all these amendments, and that maybe a rewrite is in order, just to stipulate it. Maybe just a constitution that, you know, the first thing that's in the Constitution. And see the Bill of Rights for any rights, and if you're in doubt, you know, assume they have the right to do that, you know, kind of deal. But
if you can imagine a constitutional convention brought to you by the Koch brothers.
I'm not convinced that it could be done today.
But you know, I think the problem is more fundamental than that, Chris, because you in Canada and we in the United States are. Heirs to the English idea of a common law, wherein the law is shaped by decisions of a court applying statutes passed by a legislative body. This is not the same as other European legal forms. You know, to be a judge in France or to be a judge in Germany is not the same as being a judge in England, Canada, or the United States by a pretty wide margin. You know, a judge in Spain actually does the investigating of a case, if I understand correctly. Whereas a judge in the Anglo jurisprudential system sits back and waits for an adversarial system to bring the evidence to her. And that in its own right, I mean, if you want to talk about, I mean, you know, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, papers, and effects, and no search warrant shall issue but upon an affidavit of probable cause, is a pretty clear statement, isn't it?
Oh, I mean,
there's not a hell of a lot of weasel room in there. But when John Marshall declares that the Supreme Court of the United States shall be the final arbiter of what a law means and whether it is constitutional, and that the Supreme Court shall be the final interpreter of the Constitution, Pandora's box, in that little moment in Marbury versus Madison, Pandora's box goes, boop, it's open, the jack-in-the-box springs out, and it's got big, sharp, nasty teeth, right? And you get and suddenly, well, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, papers, and effects. Well, what the hell are my emails if they're not my effects?
Well, Bob, I was just wondering, if that Robertson decision didn't come down, how would the Senate stop the House from imposing upon it, literally just ignoring one another, or the Senate to start taxation and bills of attainder and all that? If there wasn't some body or person or something out there to act as a referee, if you will, how the hell would you keep one House from literally making war upon the other?
It was anticipated.
The Republicans controlled the House and the Democrats controlled the Senate.
It was anticipated that that's exactly what would happen, because the whole system was designed not for action but for stasis. You know, George Washington has said, perhaps apocryphally, to have created, made that analogy when they asked him, you know, when they asked him a similar question. He took his tea, which was boiling hot in his little porcelain cup and had just been brought to him more than likely by a slave. And he said, "The hot tea in this cup are the passions of the people's house." And then he poured some into the saucer and waited a moment and drank it once cool and said, "We shall cool those passions in the saucer of the Senate." They were supposed to be at odds with one another. They were given things that the other could not do. The Senate could say yay or nay on presidential appointments and ratifying treaties, and the House was given the purse strings.
Washington was a general, right? He's familiar generally with war and fighting, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, has he never met a Republican, or at that time a Democrat?
No.
These people are partisans. It wouldn't have been just, I'm not talking figurative, I'm talking literal, it would have been a civil war.
You gotta go and camp out with Dr. Bill for a little while. A great place to start is Federalist Number 10. James Madison wrote, as Dr. Bill has pointed out, in a language that was not supposed to be read by the lumpen' proletariat.
Mm-hmm.
And he and Professor Keith Lilly expounded upon that at considerable length, and brilliantly so. But if you sit down and you start reading the Federalist Papers and you read it carefully and you parse it slowly, you'll see exactly what they had planned. This is a system designed first and foremost to protect wealth, not rights.
Yeah. They always assume that they're all on the same side at some point. They might differ on implementation, but they're all wealthy people, landholders, whatever. And they always assumed that it would always be so, that we mere proles would never get a foot in the door, as it were. And so they have no idea about the concept of a teabagger, the poor person who goes all Stockholm syndrome with the rich, or the poor person who notices, hey, that guy eats better than anyone, just like a prisoner in a jail knows as the warden.
And if you bear in mind, of course, along the way, especially in the states, Maryland, Virginia, and southward, that the dominant religion there is some form of particularly heinous Calvinism. Well, why is that guy eating better than everybody else? God likes him better.
Always ways of covering your butt.
Yeah. Hey, Chris, I got a roll, but a brilliant discussion as ever. It's awfully good to hear from you. It's been too long.
Thanks. I'll try to get less busy.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Chris, calling from Nanaimo in British Columbia. Onward for the last couple of minutes. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Lib.
Oh, hey, Lib, how are you?
Doing well, and hope you are, too.
Trying to do well.
Keep pedaling, brother.
Yeah, I know. I hear banjo music.
That's all we can do. One subject that you have not brought up tonight is today's date.
Yes, well, August the 6th.
Yeah.
You mean Hiroshima?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did bring it up, thanks to a brilliantly penned letter by Tim at the very top of the program.
Oh, damn, I missed that. And yeah, that would have been Tim. Yeah. Because I have been to Hiroshima.
Oh.
Or Hiroshima, however you want to pronounce it. Yeah. It still pisses me off. Did you know that one of the best advocates for anti-nuclear proliferation is Truman's great-grandson?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, yeah. He has been there. He was probably there today.
Wow.
He is awesome.
Well, very few people know, Lib, that the decision to bomb Hiroshima involved a situation in which bomb Hiroshima was the default position, and Truman would have to have acted only to stop it. And
yeah.
Of course, he had an advisor who, if they'd had a dozen to drop, would have dropped them all.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. They had spent so much money on the project, you know, how can we ever explain how we wasted all this money?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, you know, so that local, you know, politics, you know, not anything about Russia and you know, all the other BS theories that are out there, the local politics of it was, you spent this much money on what? And we didn't kill them? You know? That was a big part of it. I totally agree with that.
Well, yes, indeed. Well, I'm glad we got to talk for a couple of minutes, but I got to get out of here, Lib. Good to talk to you. Hopefully we'll talk a little longer next time.
All right. Be well. Hello to everybody in the chat room.
All right. You take care. Have a good night.
Be good.
All right. Bye now. Our buddy the liberal calling in. Toward the end of the program, a lot of good conversations tonight, and I hope good information. We got very close. Well, not very well. We got within, thank you, Gene. We got to 22 people, so we will be 370 tomorrow night. $370 to catch even with July and get August on an even footing. Thanks very much to everybody who makes all this happen, first and foremost you, who, with your kind contributions, make it possible for us to continue. A. B. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. He literally saved progressive radio on the Internet when he founded the White Rose Society. And thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and AIC Act. .org. Also, thank you, Gene, for getting after your elected representatives to try to help get them on board. It is your activism that is making the AIC Act grow and proceed and go forward. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Rick Smith is next on the Horn.